Arkansas's roster of influential musicians includes Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Louis Jordan, and Johnny Cash. Randy Dixon with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History talks with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about another legend, Jimmy Driftwood, for this week's Pryor Center profile.
Underneath that old apple tree, yesterday I got a letter saying, sweetheart, please come back to me.
That is the legendary Arkansas singer, songwriter, educator, ambassador, and more, Jimmy Driftwood. He is singing about the White River there. And with me to talk more about Jimmy Driftwood in our Pryor Center profile segment this Monday is Randy Dixon, who is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy Dixon, welcome back to Ozarks at Large.
Thank you. How are you, Kyle?
I'm doing pretty good, and I'm excited to talk about Jimmy Driftwood, who is indeed legendary.
Well, he was born in 1907, and his real name was James Corbett Morris. He changed it to Driftwood in the 50s, early 50s, in Timbo, a little town in Stone County. And kind of an interesting way he got his name. When he was born, his grandmother came to see newborn Jimmy, and as a prank, his grandfather had wrapped a bunch of sticks and twigs up in a blanket and showed it to her, and she said, she got all, not upset, but put out, I guess. And so that's just nothing but a bunch of driftwood. And that kind of stuck. And he actually legally changed his name in the 50s to Driftwood. He learned to play actually on his grandfather's homemade instrument. The neck is a rail fence, and the body is an old ox yoke. And then the head and bottom were pieces from the headboard of his grandmother's bed. So it's an interesting looking instrument. I guess you'd call it a guitar. It has six strings. It's really, it has a great sound to it.
Yeah.
He went to a school in the area, one room schoolhouse. It only went to the eighth grade. But even with an eighth grade education, you could take the teacher license test. And he took it and passed it. And he was teaching by the age of 16 there in the Timbo area, and went to John Brown College in Siloam Springs, and then ended up getting a degree from what is now University of Central Arkansas, which is where all of his papers are now. But in the 20s and 30s, he left Arkansas for the Southwest, and during that time, he wrote hundreds of songs, but he had never thought about pursuing a musical career. But then he returned to Arkansas in the 30s to teach, started teaching, and married Cleta Johnson, one of his former students from years before. And but during his absence, he says he never quit missing Stone County.
I love this country. I just love the country, and I want to live here. To me, this is the most beautiful country in the world. And the people are here. They're the people I've always known. I was reared with this type of people. And I don't only love to live with them and be with them, but I've always wanted to do anything that I could to try to help our people and bring our part of the country forward a little so that they'd have a better way of life.
We're also going to hear a little bit about what I think it's kind of a cut and dry issue, what his most famous song was, right?
Yes, Battle of New Orleans.
Which went to number one on the pop charts and I think the country charts when recorded by Johnny Horton.
That's right. It also won the first ever country music Grammy in 1960 and won a Grammy for Song of the Year. He wrote 6,000 folk songs, and more than 300 of them were recorded by other artists. But a lot of the songs he wrote as a teaching tool to keep the students' interest about a history subject, he would sing it. So the Battle of New Orleans was actually written for a high school class he was teaching in Snowball. And there's a little example here of him performing, and he's out on his farm.
In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans. We met the bloody British near the town of New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming, but there wasn't nigh as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Well, I seed Mars Jackson walking down the street, talking to a pirate by the name of Jean Lafitte. He gave Jean a drink that he brought from Tennessee, and the pirate said he'd help us drive the British in the sea. Fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't nigh as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. It might seem strange that you would be singing a battle song in a valley so peaceful and so beautiful, but this is really not a battle song. It's a song that was written after the battle was over. And the reason for singing it here is because of the title of this land as to who got it and why. Of course, everybody knows that this entire country in here was at one time belonged to France and pitched back from France to Spain like a football. But finally, Thomas Jefferson bought it from Napoleon in 1803. Then in 1812, we had another battle, a war with England, called the War of 1812. And the end of that war, of course, was the Battle of New Orleans, January the 8th, 1815. In that battle was a soldier by the name of Henry Williams. All soldiers in that war were given land west of the Mississippi if they wanted it. And Henry Williams chose this spot of land on which we stand for having fought in that war. I'm sure that he was like I am, that he felt like that this beautiful Timbo Valley was, well, just the most wonderful place in the world to live.
He worked hard to become educated. He, you know, went through a lot. I believe he walked to Siloam Springs to go to school at John Brown College. In an interesting way, he was discovered by a folklorist from Southwestern University, John Quincy Wolfe, who was actually born in Batesville, but dedicated himself to the folk life in that part of Arkansas, and he gave Driftwood some advice. And he tells the story about meeting Jimmy.
I went to see Jimmy, I suppose, about 1951. I was told about him by the postmistress at Timbo. And incidentally, the postmistress says, "You ought to look up Jimmy Morris." Said he knows every old song that was ever sung in this county, and he knows all the old people, and he knows all their songs. So I spent a half day listening to Jimmy sing and was really amazed at at the way he put over the songs and at his great repertory. When I left him, I said, "Mr. Morris, you sing in a very, very unusual manner, and you know a tremendous number of songs, you know that. I think that you ought to be recording for one of the really big companies."
We're talking about Jimmy Driftwood on this week's Pryor Center Profiles with Randy Dixon from the Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Let's continue the story of Jimmy Driftwood, Randy.
Okay, well, you know, John Quincy Wolfe told him he ought to get in touch with some big name record companies, and he ended up, not at first, but he ended up taking his advice. And boy, did it pay off. 1959 was a big, big year for Jimmy Driftwood. He had two huge hits, the Battle of New Orleans, of course, which we've heard, and Tennessee Stud, which you may be familiar with. But Tennessee Stud was recorded by Eddie Arnold, and it was actually nominated for a Grammy, didn't win. And then the Battle of New Orleans that was recorded by Johnny Horton that won. the song of the year. And Jim Pidcock asked him about the popularity of his music.
What kind of effect did your two records, The Battle of New Orleans and Tennessee Stud, have on your life?
Well, of course, there were other songs besides those. Those were possibly the two biggest ones, along with He Had a Long Chain On, which Peter, Paul, and Mary did. But the thing, I think the effect that that had on my life was that it, after all, I was raised on a farm, raised in this country. We all had a pretty hard time as you know, when I was a youngster. Had to work for your education, go to school and work your way through college and all that thing. I think that's fine now. That's all right. But the thing it did, it let me see the rest of our country, gave me a chance to see the rest of our country. And out of that, I think I've been able to write other songs about other sections of the country than this. Of course, it's also let me see a part of Europe. And I got a chance now this summer, July and August, for the State Department to go over abroad and see what kind of country our boys in Vietnam have had.
Well, you know, by this time, he's worldwide.
Yeah.
He played Carnegie Hall. He was a member of the Grand Ole Opry. He toured Europe, and he even performed from Nikita Khrushchev. You know, his visit to the U.S. in 59, it was kind of disastrous.
Oh.
But I think he may have enjoyed Jimmy Tewitt. I don't know. But through all that, he came back to Stone County in 1963 and formed the Rack and Sack Folklore Society to promote folk music and history.
As far as I am concerned, and as far as the people in the Rack and Sack Folklore Society and the Crafts Ozark Foothills Crafts Guild is concerned, is the preservation of a folk thing.
And so Jimmy Driftwood, of course, helps establish the Ozark Folk Center, which is a state park. Now,
that's right. And he, you know, it was just an idea at the time. Everyone was so pleased with the economic boon that they were getting from, you know, the festival. It's like, well, why don't we do something that's just not one weekend? Mm. Let's expand on that. So the Folk Center idea came about, and Jimmy Driftwood stepped in and used his national celebrity towards the cause. He approached Congressman Wilbur Mills, you know, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee that holds the purse strings, about money for construction. Mills arranged to have some of the musicians come to Washington, and they performed on the steps of the state capitol. And they ended up picking up $2.1 million for construction. It's built and it's up and running, and Driftwood becomes the musical director of the Folk Center. He's running the Folk Center, basically. And here's where it gets a little dicey. You know, I'm told by people who, you know, would know that he had a really big ego, a huge ego, and could rub people the wrong way, and made a lot of enemies. But apparently up in Stone County, there was constant infighting. He could not get it resolved. And I'm told he was a part of it. And so eventually he had to be fired by someone we know, Governor David Pryor.
Folk Center is not the property of Stone County necessarily. It is not even the property entirely of the state of Arkansas, even though we maintain and operate it. The Folk Center belongs to the entire state, it belongs to the nation, and we must, in order to make it work well, remove it from local politics. And that was what we were attempting to do.
You know, it gets resolved, and look at what you've got there now in Mountain View with the Folk Center.
Oh, it's wonderful. But, you know, that's not all he did.
Right.
You know, he persuaded the U.S. Forest Service to develop and promote Blanchard Springs Caverns. And then he had a big hand in making the Buffalo River a national river. Let's close out with another portion of the White River Valley. Is that okay?
That's fine. Randy Dixon, thank you so much for your visit again this week. Randy is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Put in Pryor Center in a Google search, and you will find their website and all kinds of history there. Randy, let's do this again.
Let's do it.
White River Valley, I love my White River home.
Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums.